Here we are with another Mystic Pete Chronicles on KXLU 88.9 FM in LA, KXLU.com all around the world. Mystic Pete here with a dear friend and colleague and in-house philosopher, Mark Porter Zasada.
Hi, Pete.
We've done a lot of shows together, and you tend to be the adult in the room, and I try to keep up with my, you know, corny jokes and stuff. No, I don't know, but you have a very interesting talk that we're going to get to in a minute.
Okay.
We've done several already. What are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're going to head down a very interesting rabbit hole. It has to do with story. It has to do with myth. It has to do with religion. It covers a lot of ground. But let me tell you where I started. I sat down and I thought maybe about 10% of what people believe is true at any moment. Seriously. Think about the thoughts that run through your mind in a day. This project is going to work out. My spouse hates me. My spouse trusts me. My children are doomed. My children are geniuses. That meal I just paid $100 for was remarkable. They really like me at work. How much of that do you really know? Not hope, not fear, but know. My guess is not much. The rest is myth, assumption, story. Maybe 4 hours a day are spent imagining what our lovers think of us or our bosses, another couple of hours picturing ourselves in some heroic or tragic light. Then there are sales pitches, political ideologies, sex fantasies, financial predictions, novels, movies, video games, rock anthems, fashion, and, of course, sleep. I mean, dreams, right? So I figure that leaves maybe 30 minutes a day for reality. Usually around 3 in the morning, maybe. That's when you wake in a cold sweat thinking about the paperwork you forgot to file, the drain you never unclogged, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the drink you shouldn't have had. Reality has a habit of visiting around 3 a.m., but then mercifully we fall back to sleep, back into story, back into myth. So when I think about it, maybe 10% reality is a generous estimate. And maybe our species has always lived this way. I mean, yeah, we're inundated by story, right? Day and night, endless channels. But consider the Greek myths. Consider cave paintings of brilliant buffalo hunts. I mean, well, maybe we've always lived this way. Then there's religion, which I want to get out of the way really quickly because I don't really want this to be about religion tonight. It's estimated that there are about 10,000 distinct active religions being practiced in our own day. Okay, 73% of humans subscribe to one of the big four, but there are millions in smaller religions, Sikhism, Judaism, Baha'i, Jainism, Shinto, Taoism, Zoroastrianism. Some of these groups happily live within their own stories, not caring about the stories of others. Some are always trying to get everyone else into their own story. One assumes they can't all be true. So yeah, I think my percentages are still pretty accurate.
That's interesting. So what you're saying is perhaps 10% of what we believe is true. 10% of our thoughts are accurate. And religion, well, I mean, if we have thousands of religions, obviously.
Some of them might not be true.
Some of them might not be true, I think.
It's possible.
If
not anyone who's listening. But,
no, not those people, because they're KXLU listeners,
exactly.
And they're cool and very intelligent. But if they're claiming they are the one true religion, there can't be thousands of them making that claim, and they're all true, mutually exclusive. That's the word.
That's probably a fair judgment on the situation. But we're going to leave the subject of religion, because I just wanted to get that out of the way. And I just want to raise the question, is this a flaw in humanity, or is it the design to live within myth, live within story, okay? In fact, maybe it's worth remembering that one of the things we're told separate human beings from other animals is our extraordinary ability to imagine something before we do it. We can consider a proposal, a purchase, a decision at work, play the whole thing out in our heads, not just what will happen, but how we'll feel when it happens. It's a remarkable human ability. We can rehearse the future without actually having to live it. That's story, right? Except, as I said, we're apparently not very good at it. We imagine how happy we'll be after buying an expensive car, getting the promotion, moving into a beautiful house, marrying that person, quitting the job. We don't really know how we'll feel until we've crossed into that new reality and lived there for a while.
Yeah, it's one of the conundrums of modern day life, of life at any time of humanity.
Life at any time. So buyer's remorse. Suddenly we discover that the emotion we imagined isn't the emotion we actually feel. And the story we were living in when we were buying the house or the car or marrying that unfortunate person wasn't actually the true story we were occupying. We were in one story, and then we realized that we were actually living in another story all along. This is a very common,
deep
human situation. But is it a problem, or is it the way we have to live? Is it that illusion is some occasional malfunction of the human imagination, or is it something that comes packaged with imagination itself and actually moves us forward as humanity and in our personal lives? And I'm not going to answer that question. I'm going to explore it tonight with you.
Well, beautiful. Let's just take a quick musical break.
Okay.
And then we can gather and keep going on. It's a lot to think about. Let's just take a breath.
We'll take a breath.
And play a little cool music. And here we go. KXLU, Mark Porter Zasada, continuing.
We're back. So we are talking about the power and perhaps necessity of illusion and story in our lives. Is it a malfunction or is it a necessity? Because honestly, if we spent every waking second confronting life exactly as it is, war, disease, betrayal, aging, mortality, people we've disappointed, people we're going to lose, could we bear it? Or would we just run raving into the night? Maybe human beings were never meant to live on facts alone. Now, that sounds almost heretical these days, because we claim to worship facts and admire people who tell it like it is. We celebrate science for stripping away superstition. And sure, science does astonishing things. But here's the strange thing. The more facts we accumulate, the more stories we seem to require. And boy, do we invent them every day. Novels, streaming services, confessional podcasts, political narratives. My God, the fire hose of story has become almost unbearable itself. So Carl Jung, the philosopher, noticed this paradox more than 100 years ago. Jung is one of those thinkers who's really hard to classify, part psychologist, part philosopher, part mystic. Some of his ideas have aged poorly, but every now and then he noticed something that feels embarrassingly obvious once you've seen it. Most importantly, he suggested that the human mind doesn't organize itself around facts at all. It organizes itself around meaning. And those aren't the same thing. Facts tells me the earth goes around the sun. Meaning tells me whether it's worth getting out of bed to see the sunrise. Facts explain the history of the wedding ring. Meaning explains why a widow still wears one 50 years after her husband dies.
Beautiful analogy.
We don't really act on facts. We act on meaning. And meaning usually arrives through story. We occupy a story that has meaning, and that determines our actions, not the facts on the ground. We're fooling ourselves if we think, if you ever had a political conversation with someone and tried to convince them with facts, you know what I'm talking about. You can spit facts all day, but if you construct a narrative, and all political consultants talk about narrative all the time, you have a much better chance of convincing them of something. So Jung went further. He thought the deeper parts of the mind don't think in propositions, logical propositions at all. They think in images, symbols, and stories. Long before children can define courage, they understand the knight entering the forest. Long before they can define sacrifice, they understand the parent who stays behind so someone else can escape. Whatever. Stories orient us. So fiction has a lot to say for it. And I don't think anyone would disagree with me. In fiction, we enter a universe that makes sense. Events happen for reasons. Details that seem meaningless turn out to matter. The gun introduced in Act 1 goes off in Act 3. Characters discover their purpose and then work to fulfill it. Even suffering usually means something in a story.
Chekhov, by the way. Yeah, okay. I just had to show how literate I was.
Oh, okay. It's almost if God is visibly arranging the universe towards some logical outcome. I mean, think about rom-coms, right? It's inevitable those two are going to find each other and fall in love. Real life, of course, is not so cooperative at all. Important things happen for no apparent reason. Terrible people sometimes prosper. Wonderful people get cancer. Relationships understand without anyone understanding why at all. Loose ends remain loose in real life. Characters disappear halfway through the story and never come back. That's why fiction can feel strangely more real than reality. Not because its events are true, but because the structure satisfies something deep inside us. Fiction, or any story we tell ourselves, including those stories about our bosses and our lovers and so on, give us what life, the facts, the true facts of life, often refuse to provide. Coherence. Beginning, middle, and end. Cause and effect. Purpose. And that's why fiction is not just entertainment. Some amount, I think, is essential to human mental survival. I don't think anyone would argue with that either. So we spend a few hours inside a universe where things make sense. This raises, though, a question that's pretty crucial. What is philosophy in relationship to story? When people think about how to live their lives, they don't really often refer to Kant or Spinoza or any of the great philosophers. They often think about heroic stories that they've seen. And that's probably always been true. David Hume, the philosopher, said that stories predate philosophy and always have, and that philosophy is a rationalization of the story that someone's already occupying, that they've already emotionally registered what they're doing, and then they write a lot of books about it. Fundamentally, the story predates the philosophy itself. Politicians understand this instinctively. Religions understand this instinctively, that the story has to predate the ethics or the systemization into a philosophy. All the great religions offer plenty of ethical rules, but they really do organize themselves around stories. Abraham, Moses, the Passion of Jesus, Buddha beneath the Bodhi tree. Stories tell believers not merely what to believe, but what kind of life they're living. Go into any church or mosque or synagogue, there's plenty more talk about stories than about fine points of ethics. But I said I wasn't going to talk about religion anymore, and here I am doing it again. Most people these days, I shouldn't say most people, but we get our stories and our moral tales from Netflix, Marvel, self-help books, so on. And most of those stories are moral tales. They're organized around a principle like great courage will win out in the end, loyalty matters more than anything, and so on. So it's not like popular culture has abandoned the ethical universe of philosophy, because indeed most of those stories do demonstrate some kind of ethical principle.
Let's take a little quick musical break, and then we will continue the story.
Okay.
All right, we are back here at KXLU, and I am speaking with Mark Porter Zasada. The question I have is, everything is changing in terms of facts and stories. Facts are becoming mushy. There's alternative facts, and story is happening all the time, but it's to sell something. It's like a phony story. It has another agenda rather than a moral tale. It's been contaminated. And this is what we're dealing with right now. facts and stories becoming polluted.
So the question is, was there a time when facts mattered more than they do now? Or are we simply living in a time where there's no agreed story and set of facts to support it? So have the facts broken down, or has the agreed story broken down? And now we have all these competing stories, because I would submit that facts always are designed to fit into stories, not the other way around.
Insightful.
We all assume that we see a set of facts, like Sherlock Holmes made all these observations and then constructed a story around it. But I think the truth is that we construct a story, we live within a story, and then we assemble the facts to support it over and over again. People lived in a religious society. They assembled the facts around them to support what they were seeing. People who live in a communist society see every fact filtered, so-called fact, assembled, rejected, to fit into that story of the terrible capitalists and the fall of the West is imminent and so on and so forth.
Well, then the whole like conspiracy theorists, where they have a conclusion and then they find the facts that support it. I mean, the same kind of thing, but this is widespread right now.
It's widespread because the filter has come off thanks to the internet, and any conspiracy theory, any story can be put out there. And people who put out these stories understand that their audience will assemble facts, quote unquote, to support it. We're always trying to argue with people, well, the facts say this, but people don't care what the facts say. They care what the narrative is, and they know they can assemble the facts into it however they want. I don't want to get into specific political events, but we all know tremendous political events that have completely different narratives surrounding them.
Yeah, and more efforts going into creating those constructed narratives. It's kind of post-truth society.
What I would submit was, and many people would say, was there a truth society that's now been destroyed?
Oh, good point.
Or was there always? I'm suggesting that there was a shared narrative in the days of Walter Cronkite and so on. There was a shared narrative about what America meant and so on, and the facts would be assembled to fit it. And that this has always been true throughout history.
Yeah, like
there's nothing new.
The prosperity of the 50s and all this optimism, yes, unless you were in poverty and in a place of America that was destitute, then you weren't part of that glowing city on the hill.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that there's the counter narrative is true, quote unquote, either. It's that you occupy a story, and I'm not criticizing this in human beings. It's the way we survive. No one can live without story. No one can live their life without imagining some kind of organizing story to make it make sense. So we're in a time where and everyone feels it. Everyone feels that the organizing story of America has fallen apart in some way. We can't like put our finger on it, but you feel that, and it's not a good feeling. It's not a good feeling at all. But philosophers throughout history have said that the crucial thing is to try to stop living within a story that might be an illusion and try to get past it to reason. Because, of course, the dangers of living within a story are profound. One is that most stories are constructed around concepts of good and evil, and we're inundated with stories like that all the time. And this clear division between good and evil, police stories, horror stories, political stories, you name it. So much so that we attempt as humans to reduce all our life stories to good versus evil. the boss is a bad guy and I'm a good guy, or my spouse is a bad guy and I'm the good guy. We're always trying to put it in those categories because that's the way we think about story. It's a reductio ad absurdum of political stories, certainly, that there must always be a good guy and a bad guy. So we fall into these camps, but to me, it's just the habit. It's the habit that story produces. And there's a deeper, to get into the more mystical side of it, of story. In the West, particularly, story, quote-unquote, depends on a protagonist. It depends on a focus on one person who's in contrast to their environment. Think about that for a second. The lead character is always battling against the outer world from themselves, whether to overcome it or join it. They're the one who matters in the story, and the rest is a kind of background. So this creates this profound separation, this selfish danger that comes with any time you interpret the world as story. In our time, since the rise of the novel, this idea of individual liberty and the individual story, I think, has really warped our view of everything. It's a Western thing that's kind of taken over the world. Philosophers, in general, over history, have tried to militate against this problem, this story, this illusion that people live in. So Plato, channeling Socrates, was probably the first great example. In the Republic, he famously, in fact, worries about poets because Homer shapes people's souls more powerfully than philosophy does. He feared story precisely because they worked. And so he tried to, everyone who was living in their story, he tried to question them and break them out of their story. That's what the Socratic dialogues are about, right? It's like breaking people out of their story and them stepping back and saying, wait, my assumption about my own self-righteousness is probably not true. You can go through lots of great philosophers. Descartes tried to distrust every inherited story, tradition, authority, even the senses. I think, therefore, I am. That's just, that's it. Spinoza tried to understand human emotion with almost geometric rationality. Kant constructed a magnificent architecture of duty and reason and universal moral law that nobody reads and nobody cares about. Okay. Even Plato ended up telling stories in order to get his point across. The cave, the ring of Gyges, the myth of Ur. He invented stories in order to actually change people's minds. Which brings us to Buddhism, because Buddhism is a very important part of this conversation about story. In many ways, meditation, Buddhist meditation, is an attempt to escape story, if you think about it. To suspend for a time one's role as a protagonist and just be. That's why it's so hard to do. And in Buddhism, the idea is this, people misunderstand Buddhism to say that all life is an illusion. It's really that the mind is always generating stories and illusions. You get an email from somebody and you read it wrong and you say, this person hates me. And you may believe that for days if you don't talk to the person and find out that's not actually true. The mind is always generating these stories. And the idea is that before you get trapped in a story, you step outside and you examine it. That's what Plato said to do. That's what Buddhism is always telling us to do, is to fight illusion. And this is, okay, now, this is me personally trying to understand all this. I'm not speaking for Buddhism or anything. I'm no expert, okay? But to me, going back to that fundamental idea of the story is the idea of protagonist in opposition to their environment and acting separate from it. So when you talk about merging with universe in meditation, which anyone who's ever tried it understands the goal of that, they feel that this kind of letting go of the self and so on. or you just feel it viewing the ocean or standing in a meadow, you're really, I think, talking about stepping outside of story for a moment. Just being part of a landscape. If you're standing in front of the ocean, you can, for a moment, escape story. You're just part of the landscape without any accompanying narrative. It's like a great philosophical goal that we all feel it, whatever religion we are, whatever we've studied, we feel that desire to escape story for a moment. The sunset is beautiful regardless of the story you are presently occupying.
So here we are at KXLU. I am interviewing Mark Porter Zasada, and we are talking about facts, ideas, philosophy, story. I guess the question I have, going back into the content of story, one of the great changes in Western civilization's story was when religion ended, right around the time of Descartes. In other words, it went from religion being the main story, and then Descartes said, well, no, it's actually maybe something else. It's thought. It's because we're intelligent. And then along comes Nietzsche, and God is dead. So there was a profound shift in the story, and I'm not sure we've come up with something better yet. But I'm drawing us back into the content of story, and you're saying, well, let's look at the meta. So how do we get out of story completely? I'm just putting out this major shift in storytelling in Western civilization. And then I also want to introduce this other idea that is present, and that's divine madness, ecstasis, mania. In other words, these are forces the ancient Greeks recognized. All kinds of civilizations have recognized getting out of story, getting out of self. In fact, Plato talked about ecstasis, and that was the real way you knew about facts and truth. People concentrate with Plato on his content, but often miss this other aspect of losing our mind.
So you just said a lot of different things.
I did.
I'm going to divide it into two pieces, okay? So the second thing that you talked about is this kind of duality between reason and madness and the necessity of the madness. And that is a whole show unto itself.
But isn't that getting out of the story?
No, it's not.
Okay.
In ancient times, it wasn't at all. Okay. Because now we're going to go on a little diversion before we get back
to the point.
Okay. Well, you brought us. The two parts of the things that you talked about. One was basically the Enlightenment, and
yes.
The other is the duality in the human psyche between madness and reason, which is certainly related. And I'll just take a moment to say, in ancient times, those two things were mixed together in story all the time. The gods were tricksters. The stories, there wasn't this contrast between reason and madness. They were all mixed up in the same stories. And we should go there, but maybe not today.
Okay.
it's actually a fascinating thing that I've been reading quite a bit about lately. So okay. I want to go there eventually in another show. But let's talk about the Enlightenment, because that's what you brought up. You said religion ended. Well, I'm sorry, religion didn't end. That would be something of an overstatement. But religion was challenged, we think, we like to say, by rationality. Okay, Voltaire, Locke, Jefferson, all argued for reason over story. But was it reason over story, or was it a different story being told? They were telling a new story about the power of human reason and the human mind to conquer the world around us, to tame it, to control it without the help of divine agency. it really was a new story. Think about Jefferson, the great rationalist who changed the world. He told this powerful story: all men are created equal. People should be allowed to pursue happiness. That's a story. It's a tremendous state. We think about it as he says we hold these truths to be self-evident. That is a magnificent BS statement.
BS statement?
Yes, because where do those truths come from? They're a story. They're a counter story. They're a story in and of themselves that we've been living out as we are enlightenment creatures. And it has been one of the most successful stories in all of the 100,000 whatever years of human history, to live out the rational story of scientific realism, of the scientific method, of engineering, math, and all the things that have come from it. And yet it is a story, trust the human mind, trust human freedom, that actually has no basis except a guy like Jefferson saying these truths are self-evident, okay? And you mentioned Nietzsche, because something changed at that some weird, terrible moment. One of the most brilliant people who ever lived, whether or not you like what he said. He recognized the power of myth, and he argued that human beings create their own values out of myth rather than discovering nothing was self-evident. Okay. His solution, create new myths. Yeah, that led to trouble. Then think we got to, just to do like the little brief survey of human reason here since the Enlightenment, we got to Sartre and Camus, the existentialists who came along and agreed that we create meaning ourselves from nothing. There's nothing self-evident. There's no stories that predate us. You're going to start from nothing, existentialism. Existence precedes essence, is the idea. But what made them famous? Their novels. The Stranger, Nausea. They created new stories. So maybe rationalities. So philosophy is, most philosophers, and you can't generalize about anything, but let's just say most philosophers in some way try to break us out of story and step back and look. But their greatest opponent, you know, really wasn't religion in a lot of ways. I think it was more like Shakespeare. Okay? Because think how many people have been changed more deeply by Hamlet, King Lear, Anna Karenina, other great works, Les Miserables, The Brothers Karamazov, rather than reading Kant or reading, like I said, or reading who reads Spinoza and quotes him, right? But we're all quoting Shakespeare and Tolstoy. There's something about Shakespeare in particular that I want to bring up, and as a paradigm of much great literature. Shakespeare's plays are often about characters who discover that the story they've been using to organize their lives isn't true at all. King Lear inhabits a story in which love can be measured through public declarations, his kingdoms, his daughters, his identity all rest on that narrative. And it's dead wrong. Cordelia refuses to perform it, and Lear's whole world collapses. He doesn't just lose a kingdom, he loses the story through which he understands reality. This is a very common theme in literature. Macbeth inhabits this crazy story that power will satisfy ambition, and ambition is the be-all and end-all. Othello, of course, inhabits Iago's story instead of Desdemona's. Hamlet can't decide what story he's living in. That's what makes it one of the greatest works in literature. He's trying out all these different stories: the avenging son, the philosopher, the prince, the lover. And until he inhabits a story, which he does eventually, he can't act. Once he inhabits a story, that's why we so identify with Hamlet, because when we're without a story to occupy, we're helpless. We can't do anything. And the same pattern appears everywhere in great literature. Don Quixote literally inhabits the wrong story. My favorite is probably the greatest example to me is Prince Andre in War and Peace. There's the great moment in War and Peace. He's in the Battle of Austerlitz. He's wounded while charging with a flag, and he falls on his back. He looks upward and suddenly notices the enormous tranquil sky above his head. Until then, he's idolized Napoleon and dreamed of achieving his own moment of heroic glory. But looking up, everything seems petty and artificial compared to the great story in the sky. And when Napoleon literally approaches him, the great man he worshipped, he seems small and insignificant. It's this great revelatory moment of realizing there's a greater story than the one you live in. But there's plenty of other examples. Madame Bovary lives inside romantic novels that aren't true. Gatsby builds an entire seductive identity around a fantasy that we still love to play out somehow now. So the tragedy in all these stories isn't merely ignorance, it's narrative commitment. The inability to step outside a story in which a person is trapped.
KXLU, Mark Porter is Asada. We are on the home stretch of this interview. Let me throw another left turn idea,
okay. And
then you'll somehow knit it all together into some kind of cohesive conclusion. We count on you for that.
It's good to have a challenge.
Yes. Well, going back to one of our earlier comments, we're in an era where story and facts are contaminated, where there's truthiness, where there's alternative facts, where stories are designed to sell and they're just hollow commercial objects. Is it possible that because of the almost crisis in facts and storytelling and the co-opting of it all by malicious forces, by robots, AI, bad actors, that we as a society naturally start to transcend story and start to transcend the facts of it and step outside, like back to what you're saying, a place of stillness, of mindfulness, of stepping outside, like within the structure that's collapsing, we all have a moment of enlightenment?
Okay. So the question is, are the great philosophers the enemy of story? And should we be the enemy of story? Should we try to rise above all story in some meditative, enlightened state? The problem with that is that without story, you cannot take action. You act within a story. If you have no narrative, you preclude action. Even the great sages of the East had to build things and make a society work. And so they had to live within a story to do that. Everyone does. So I don't think philosophy is really the enemy of story. Maybe it's the editor. Maybe it asks what stories deserve to organize our lives, which are dangerous. But maybe philosophy has an even more important job. Maybe philosophy and all these thinkers who are worth reading exist to help us notice that we are inside a story at all. Socrates wandered around Athens asking awkward questions because everyone around him was living inside unquestioned narratives about justice and courage, virtue, and success. That's why he's still so relevant today. He didn't necessarily offer people a better story. He created distance from the old one for them. He made them step outside of it. And maybe that's philosophy's greatest gift, not reason as such, but distance. Because you have to distance from reason, too, to get back to your thought about craziness. Socrates asked, what do you mean? Buddha asked, what is this desire? The Stoics asked, is this under my control? Each creates a little space between the mind and the story. And maybe that space is where freedom actually lives. And this brings me back to something I've noticed about genuinely wise people, great leaders, the great leaders of companies and nations. They don't rush. It's not because they're indecisive. It's because they've learned to mistrust their first interpretation of things. Most of us, whatever happens, we immediately interpret it within a story that we're telling ourselves, right? But really wise people wait. They know that a story will appear, but other stories will appear too. You know, they get an email. Is this person angry? Maybe. Am I being sidelined? Am I going to lose my job? The wise person waits. Not forever. You have to act eventually. But you have to wait long enough to remember that the first story arriving at your door isn't necessarily the only story available. Wise people know they are inhabiting stories. It's a sign of maturity to know that to say, yes, I'm living in the story, whether it's a religious story that I'm living in, whether it's a career story, but you know it's a story ultimately. And you know there are other stories out there besides that one.
So there's a sense of flow about these people, a rhythm, a pace.
Yes.
And that also helps them observe the story.
So the critical element is not what you believe, but what you do. It's not what you believe, but what you do. So do you take enough time to examine the story before you take action? Because until you act, it doesn't matter what you believe. But once you take action, that's it. If there's one message that you can take maybe from the great philosophers and maybe from this discussion is, before you do something, you ask, what story has my mind just constructed? And can I wait long enough to see whether it's the only one? Can I just have some patience? Patience is not a modern virtue. We don't usually celebrate people with patience. In fact, it's just the opposite. We celebrate people who go out and break things. But the great philosophers throughout history, like, just step back a minute. What myth are you inhabiting? What story are you inhabiting? Can you achieve some distance? Can you achieve some humility before you act?
Well, I think we climbed that mountain. That's deep.
It's simple. It's a definition of maturity in many ways. A lot of just being a mature human being is taking that moment before you act. And so I don't know. I don't think maturity is escaping illusion and story. We already established in the beginning here that 90% of what we believe probably is never true anyway. It's impossible. You have to live within a story. But maturity is learning to pause when a story grips us, to step outside of it for a moment and just wait. And I think that's what true human freedom is. Because if you are acting only within the parameters of a pre-established story, you don't have freedom. It's your essential right as a human being to step outside of the story you're occupying and look at it.
Wise words. Mark Porter, Azasada. A long journey packed into 1 hour. We have to say goodbye and continue the series next month or in a couple months.
I think we should do a part two and a part three.
I'll tell you,
my part two is the structured Hollywood movie story and how it's changed all of our brains.
Yeah. Oh.
That's part two. And I think part three is the one you brought up now about the duality between the rational and the crazy, which I think is a really fun conversation to have.
People can reach me at mysticpete.com and mysticpete on social media, and people can find you.
I have a podcast at stayinghuman.net. You can also get my book, which I guess I can pitch. Can I pitch my book?
You could just mention it. Yeah, we can't ask
people. Oh, we can't ask people. No, okay.
We can't ask
people.
I
have a book out called The Impossible Shore.
Yeah.
It's actually a set of short stories all on a theme, which is available where you usually get books.
And I have read the book cover to cover, enjoyed every word. It's a powerful piece. Yes.
Thank you.
Say the name again.
The Impossible Shore by Mark Porter Zasada. And my website is stayinghuman.net.
So I hope everybody just leaves their radio on KXLU 88.9 FM in Los Angeles and KXLU.com all around the world. It has been an absolute delight, Mark Porter Zasada, and we will definitely do this again.
Thank you so much, Pete.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Mystic Pete out!